Join me in welcoming Ambassador Carolina Bass.
Thank you very, very much. Oh, I think I have to do this first. Thank you very, very much for this very warm welcome. And Dr. Lovegall, thank you very much for inviting me here today to be at the Einaudi Institute. And all I received is a very, very warm welcome at lunch, a beautiful day. They say Cornell is cold and rainy, but it's the middle of November and it's nice and sunny, so I don't know where that story comes from. And I have very warm memories also of Cornell because my sister went to Cornell and was at the communications program. And I came here, I went to Wellesley, and that was more quiet. And I came here and she lived in the International House. And they had a lot of parties and a lot of good music and a lot of fun. And so I always thought maybe Cornell was more fun. I think we studied just as hard, but I enjoyed my stay here. And then, of course, the bagels and lox on Sunday morning. And especially after that Saturday dancing, that was very, very welcome. So I'm very, very glad to be back. It's been quite a few years since I was here, and I did get a walk around, and it's a beautiful campus, and I am so pleased that we'll have a chance to talk about the Colombian-American relationship and why I think it's a very important partnership and a partnership that will be changing. But I want to start. You heard that as foreign minister, I was very interested in getting information out about Colombia. And that is because Colombia has changed a lot. And many people still have that image of that very violent Colombia that you can't visit, that you don't want to visit. And I just want to start by sort of giving you some of the newest data, and we'll go back, see what was happening in Colombia, the role the U.S. played in helping us move away from that, moving away from what was considered almost a failed state. And I think the interesting projections that we should have of a more regional view together. Colombia is a country then that has changed significantly. It has made great progress. It has stories to tell. It has challenges still. But for example, the New York Times the beginning of the 2010 said Colombia is one of the 31 places that they suggested that we go. The year before, Lonely Planet, it said, one of the 7 places to go if you were going to travel to a new place. On environment, Yale University placed Colombia among the top 10 in the Environmental Performance Index, meaning that Colombia is recognized as one of the most eco-friendly nations in the world, and it's clearly one of the most biodiverse. Because you may remember, Colombia is on the bottom of South America, it's the top of South America in the connection with Panama. We have the Andes, we have a Pacific coast, which is the rainiest coast in the world. Then we have these Andes, which divide in 3, so we have valleys going up and down with changing flora and fauna. Then we have a wonderful Amazon basin, and we have grasslands to the north, and we have even a desert way far north. So Colombia has more different birds, amphibians, reptiles than the US and Canada together. It has great, great biodiversity. It has also improved 5 positions in the Human Development Report of 2009, which shows that the money that we have been spending in education and health has led to improvement in those areas. The director of the Exim Bank recognized that Colombia is on the top of what he considers countries that have great potential for economic growth and potential for US businesses in new areas. You must remember that in those years of violence, companies didn't want to go back. We had no foreign direct investment. Now we're talking about investment in new areas such as renewable energy, gas, aviation, information technology, construction. And I think what is also very important, and many times people are not aware, Colombia is one of the oldest democracies in Latin America with a very strong institutional and civil society. And I think that's what it has allowed us to address and to be successful in moving away from the challenges posed by drugs and drug trafficking. In the 80s, drugs started coming into Colombia as cocaine became more used. We had had marijuana in Colombia, but when it was started to be produced here in the United States and in other markets for local consumption, that became less interesting in Latin America and less interesting for the Colombian drug dealers. But it was in the 80s that cocaine started taking off. At the beginning, the structure of the way the cocaine was produced was Peru and Bolivia were the places where it was produced. It was taken to Colombia and transformed and then sent up to the US market. This, of course, is a caricature, but it is sort of a description of what the situation was in the 80s. In fact, in 1989, President Bush, 41, held the first summit on 89 on drugs in Cartagena. And at that moment, he made what was considered a very brave decision, which was to fly into Cartagena, which is on our coast, come to a meeting, and leave. And that meeting was with Alan Garcia, who was a Peruvian president in his first presidency. He's now president again. With Paz Zamora, who was a president from Bolivia. They were there because these were the two countries that were the producers of the coca leaf. President Virgilio Arco was the president from Colombia. That was a country where it was transformed. And we were meeting with the United States, who were very worried about the trafficking that was going to the United States. So you had four countries that were involved. In the 90s, it devolved in such a way that Colombia integrated vertically, just beautifully, started producing, started transforming, started trafficking. And that's why, by the end of the 90s and the year 2000, Colombia had reached incredible levels of violence because illegal groups that we had had since the 60s, you may remember the time of the Cuban Revolution, of communism trying to make inroads in Latin America, Colombia and Bolivia were two of the countries that were chosen to be part of that revolution. And we ended up with guerrillas that had that ideological bent. But as time went on, they became much more rural. They were more rural guerrillas. But with the drugs, they became more and more powerful. You find that in Central America, when the Berlin Wall comes down, when money dries up for many of these groups, there are peace processes. Colombia, the FARC, were not interested in sitting down for a peace process, because these groups found a new source of funding which gave them total independence and no relationship to other movements, which were drugs. So you found that a left-wing group sort of morphed much more into a drug trafficking group. A group that had been very small all of a sudden was able to grow in numbers, had access to incredible amounts of arms, and access to more sophisticated communications. So by the end of the 90s, the levels of violence in Colombia of these groups was very high. We not only had kidnappings in the major cities, but even on roadways. There was something that was called the express sort of kidnapping. You could be in a car, they would do a roadblock, they had computers, they would look up your identity number, and you could be kidnapped fortuitously. This was a country that had, in a way, we all had to stay in our big cities. We were not traveling the country. And it was a country with great, great violence. Much of what you're seeing now in Mexico, Colombia lived it in the 80s. In 1 year, they killed three presidential candidates, a prosecutor general, two newspaper owners. They paid to kill policemen. I don't know if it was $100 per policeman. These kind of incredible, incredible violence. This was a Colombia that, by the year 2000, was reaching a very critical moment. We had gone into recession in 97. Colombia had always been a country with a very strong economy. We've always had a very orthodox economy, so we never had hyperinflation. We had never not paid our debt, and we had the saying, which was, maybe we're having a political problem, but our economy will do well. Well, you find out that when you have high levels of violence, Colombians don't want to invest, foreigners don't want to invest, your economy falls, and your social indicators fall. So in the 80s, which had been called sort of the lost decade in Latin America, Colombia had done very well and had improved until the end of the 80s when the drug problem started growing. And in the 90s, we fell back tremendously. So we're talking in the year 2000 of a country that some analysts were starting to call a failed state. And generals of Colombia were sort of wondering if we were going to be able to take back this country from the guerrillas. And at that moment, we found in the US a wonderful partner. And President Clinton and a lot of his team who are now in the government with President Obama started working with the Colombian government, who proposed that we do a Plan Colombia. And the idea of this Plan Colombia was to address the issue of the drugs. There's great concern of the growing drug use and the drugs coming into the US, and there was great concern about what was happening to this democracy in Latin America. The program was started by President Clinton, and he started working with Andrés Pastrana, who was president before President Uribe from the year 98 to 2002, and who made one last effort to reach a peace process with the FARC. And he won the presidency on the basis of trying to sit down with the FARC. And for 3 years, there were conversations, and he separated a huge area of a country, sort of the size of Switzerland, where our armed forces and our government decided that we would not enter, and in this way give them that space so that we could carry on these conversations. For 3 years we tried, for 3 years the FARC could not reach an agreement, and we started to see that they were continuing to kidnap, they were stealing cars and taking them in there, they kidnapped a senator, there was no interest. This was, for Colombia, very complicated because it meant that for 3 years the FARC took advantage and strengthened their forces. But on the other hand, it also helped us internationally to see that Colombia wanted to make peace. That if we had a problem with the FARC, it was not because we weren't willing to make an effort. It was that there was a FARC that was not interested in making peace. So when President Uribe was elected in the year 2002, we're in a very complex situation of a FARC that has become very strong, more than 20,000, 30,000 members, we don't know. And with strong communications, President Uribe, during his campaign, had a car bomb and had other assassination attempts. So the British government said, what can we do to help you with your security at the beginning while you strengthen it? He said, well, a satellite telephone would be a good idea. I don't have one, and the FARC do. The FARC had so much money coming from the drugs that they were able to have access to communications and to arms that we didn't have. So President Uribe starts by bringing confidence to the country. And in the first 6 months, he says, I am going to make the country safe so that you can drive on the main roads. This is his proposal. By Christmas time, you will be able to go from Bogota to Cartagena, or from Bogota to Cali, or from Cali to Medellin. We're talking about our major cities and our main roads. And he was able to accomplish this. There was so much concern at that moment that many of these groups left with police escorts, because people did not feel comfortable enough about going by themselves. And those who want to go by themselves, the only thing that the government asked is that they do it during the daylight, but that they would be safe. And so there were helicopters, there was police, etc. And of the 40 million Colombians, I think 20 million got up on the roads and we drove. Finally, we're taking over our country again. And he started working on security and working with Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia had three parts, and we got $1 billion the first year, and then we've been getting about $600 million each year. At that moment, the FARC had, and the FARC and drug traffickers, because we found that it both right wing plus drug traffickers plus the FARC had huge areas in the jungle where they were planting coca. We had no way of getting troops or getting anybody out to that jungle. So the idea of spraying was absolutely fundamental. It was the one way that we could go in, spray, and send an immediate message that Colombia was not going to accept drugs. We couldn't put people on the ground, one, because they would be killed by the illegal groups, and two, because we had no infrastructure there. So we started by spraying. That was one of the components, an important component of Plan Colombia, which was to help us to spray, giving us helicopter and airplane mobility. We're talking about a country that has huge tracts, the size, let's say, of Texas. I say one way to visualize Colombia, if you've not been there, is California plus Texas. California is a part of Colombia that is inhabited, that's on the mountains, that has a better climate, which is most of our population. Texas would be like our Amazon and grasslands, which is uninhabited. And that's where you had much of the drugs, and that's where you had the guerrillas. So the Plan Colombia had this part that had to do with the aerial spraying, to send this message that the drugs was unacceptable. Two, it had a part of economic development, offering an alternative to those rural agricultural people who wanted to leave the drugs and go into other kinds of products. And three, it had to do with strengthening our justice. We had a justice system that was falling apart because of the justice system one. It was dealing with more than 33,000 homicides a year. A justice system that was dealing with more than 3,000 kidnappings a year. A justice system that was being threatened, a justice system that was being corrupted. So we had a very difficult justice system. So these were the three pillars of Plan Colombia. The first 2 years, because the drug traffickers had these huge tracts over in the jungle, the spraying was very successful, and we saw the amount of area that was being produced in coca go down incredibly. And so it went down 20 and 40% very, very quickly. What happened the third and fourth year? The drug lords weren't going to just wait there for us to spray. They started saying, okay, I am going to fight back. So how did they fight back? By planting very small crops, very dispersed areas, in parklands, and under legal crops, under bananas, under coffee, to make it difficult, because you didn't want to spray people's crops, you didn't want to spray in parks, and it was very difficult to spray when you had the drugs all over the place. This is the kind of challenge you have, because the drug lords, given the kind of money that's involved, are going to fight back, and they're constantly thinking of new ways to fight back. So we had to find ways to be able to reach these new areas. Later, we also decided that you fought by going through the whole chain. So you fought down against the plants. You sought out the labs where they were transforming it. You tried to stop the planes that they were using to get the drugs out. And you worked with the U.S. to try and get consumption down, and also to be able to reach out and reach the money that they were laundering. So we were working on the whole chain. What happened, for example, in another part of the chain? When we were able to get air interdiction working together, the program was called Air Bridge Denial, which was stopping the planes from leaving by having good information, they started using rivers. And when they had fast boats that we were able to find with better radars, they started using semi-submersibles, which look sort of like they go underneath the water, and they just have this sort of tunnel to get fresh air. So it isn't a submarine, but it goes underwater. They're constantly changing their tactics, because this is a very lucrative business. And so we need to remember that we are fighting against a very, very powerful group, which has all the worst incentives to try and survive. But with Plan Colombia, we were able to start diminishing the amount of drugs produced in Colombia. We have very clear indications from the latest surveys done by the United Nations. It's gone down by at least 40%. We also have another indication because the prices of cocaine in the US has gone up by 50% for the last 2 years. So there's scarcity, which is driving the price up, and we're finding that the cocaine in the US is also less pure. They're purely more talcum powder or other things because there is less cocaine. So we're starting to see that we are making inroads, but it's taken us almost 10 years. It's hard, and this is one of the messages to Mexico. You don't win overnight, because you are fighting somebody who is really fighting you back. But we also found that as we reduced the drugs, we were also affecting the guerrillas. They had less money on hand to be able to fight back. We were also getting very good support from the US for better intelligence. And when you're fighting the drug lords, like when you're fighting guerrilla, it's not huge numbers, it's intelligence. It's being at the right place with the right information so that you can capture it. And we were able to work with your armed forces and learn that intelligence, even though it makes you feel powerful when you have it, is worth very little a few minutes later if you don't share it and do something with that information, because that information loses its potential very fast. So we created a system to be able to have much better information, and we have found then in these last 8 years that we have now been able to capture some of the greatest drug lords. And you may remember an incredible feat, which was when we went and were able to capture some political hostages that the FARC had for 6 to 8 to 10 years, where there were 4 Americans who had been held hostage. And we did this by impersonating. Our armed forces impersonated some FARC members, and we were able to convince them to bring all the hostages together. We took in some helicopters that were painted white as though they were some kind of international organization, and the FARC handed them over without realizing that this had been a ploy. And I think I'm using this just to illustrate how far we had gone together in working, in sharing information and learning how to fight back. So we now have a more weakened FARC, but we still have not won this game. And we have also found that we need to change our policies. So continuing to spray is never as good a policy as being able to go on the ground and work with the people who are on the ground. Why? Because if you just spray, all the drug traffickers do is either cut the plants down or have lots of little plants and plant again. What you want to do is work with the communities, but you want to go there and stay with them. You don't want to leave them open and vulnerable to the drug lords coming back. So we have now started a new, because we can get our troops on the ground, because we have been able to take over large areas of our country where we've beaten back the FARC, we now have a program which we've called a consolidation program, which means that we go into these areas, we work with the campesinos. If they don't want to cut down the drugs because they're afraid that the FARC will come in and take revenge against them, our police will do it. But then we will stay there with them, bring other alternative plants to plant, give them a supply of food. They need food while the plants are growing, while they have another alternative, and we need to bring in the government. We need to show that that is a part of Colombia that is receiving all of the services it requires. So justice, health, education, come in, and you go in and you stay. So we have chosen 6 areas where the drug traffickers are concentrated the highest now in Colombia, in seeking corridors to get out to the Pacific to keep on sending drugs. And we are working with your government to have this new program where we're going in on the ground and we're staying there and working with the people. And so this has led to this new Colombia that I was talking about. It's a Colombia where tourists are going back. We have 4 times as many tourists as we had just 8 years ago. And today I was very pleased to see that some students had been in Colombia. It's safe to go to our main cities. It's safe to be in Bogota. And so I would invite you. I tell a story. Disney is back with its cruise ships. So if Minnie and Mickey can go to Colombia, so can you. And you're very, very, very welcome. And in fact, I ran into the head of the Disney, and I said to him, "Do you know, I use this story. I hope you don't mind." He said, no, go ahead, because we look at the surveys that people do when they finish those Caribbean cruises, and Cartagena is the favorite. Because they say, this is like a theme park, but it's the real thing. And of course it's the real thing, because it's a colonial city. It's not a false colonial city, it's a real colonial city with an incredible military architecture, because it's a walled city with a set of double sets of fortresses, etc. And it's very beautiful, people are very warm, the music is fantastic, and it's just a wonderful place to go. But Colombia also has wonderful coffee areas, a wonderful jungle. There's just a lot of eco-tourism that you can also do. Colombia has now become a place of investment. We're finding that in the last 7 years, and even the year 2008, 2009 with the economic downturn, there's been more than $6 billion and up to $10 billion foreign direct investment in Colombia. And why? Because Colombia has a good workforce, it's now safe, and so it's a new opportunity and companies are coming into Colombia. Hewlett Packard has just gone back, has just chosen Colombia as its regional office, and we have a lot of companies going back. For example, Bogota has this program called Invest in Colombia, by which they identify companies that they think can work, would find the Colombian workforce and our conditions interesting. And they have been bringing 9 to 10 new companies each year. Marriott has built 4 hotels just in Bogota in the last couple of years. So this is a country that is booming. And it's a country that is investing also in its social programs, where we are seeking to increase our education coverage from 95% to 98%, making special programs for our rural areas where it has been more difficult and where we have the greatest problems, seeking to improve the quality, to start putting English, to improve our math, to improve our science. Does that sound familiar? Of course, our levels are lower, but we have the same kind of problems. We now have a new health system that is reaching out with a very basic health coverage to most of the population. And we're working on these issues because it becomes important and fundamental for us to invest not only in security, but to invest also in the economic and the social, and to make this a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious cycle. So that by having more security, we've had greater economic growth, we've had more social investment, and so this is a country that is moving ahead. It's also a country that had to address the issue of justice and of human rights. And given the kind of very challenging conditions that I was explaining, of a justice system thoroughly bogged down by all the thousands of cases coming up each year, 33,000 per year for the last 10, 12, 15 years, we decided to change our justice system from an inquisitorial, which is based on the Spanish, on the Napoleonic system, where the same person, the same judge, is the one who takes a deposition. You go in and you declare what you have to. He then gets all the witnesses and writes this down, then has to make the decision, has to analyze it and make the decision. It's not like you have here, you have attorneys and you have justices, and it's oral and it's more open. So we made a constitutional change to go to your oral system, and we are finding that our cases are starting to go faster. We had to develop a new institution for those people who felt threatened. There were definitely groups that at some point were being more threatened, either by the right-wing groups or by the left-wing groups. And so, for example, mayors in the outskirts, or councilmen in the outskirts, teachers, labor union members in certain areas of the country, so that we had a program that went up to be a program of $42 million a year to give security for people who felt threatened. So we tried to address these issues as we work to better our justice system and improve a situation of human rights. At this moment, we have a special unit for human rights. Human rights have the greatest, they've been given the priority. The problems that we might have had with our armed forces, because they were fighting this war, which knew no border, any case that seems to be human rights is not tried by military courts, but in our civil courts. So we have been making all kinds of changes to make sure that as we strengthen our democracy, we do it with respect to human rights. This doesn't mean we haven't had problems. Yes, we have, but we have been seeking to address these issues and make the institutional changes which will allow us to strengthen Colombia's situation, so much so that among those indicators that show change in Colombia, you may know that the United Nations now has a new Human Rights Council, and countries can volunteer to give a report. In a way, they're showing their goodwill, and they show the report, and then the other countries can question them about it. Well, Colombia decided to do this peer report. And the latest reports of the ILO, which is the International Labor Organization, have all commended Colombia for the progress that we have made in the area of labor. The US reports that your State Department brings out on human rights have also commended Colombia on the progress. So this is a country that is moving in the right direction. And it is a direction that we've been able to accomplish because there has been great dedication. The Colombian people have stayed firm. We've had a president who's been an incredible leader, but we've also counted on your support. So that partnership that we have had has been absolutely fundamental for Colombia. You came in at the moment we needed you, and we're moving ahead together. But I think now this is an interesting moment to work together in a more regional way. And what we are finding is that now that Colombia, in a way, is sort of above water, we're not drowning, we've been able now we have some breath and we can move around, we are now starting to work with our neighbors. Because this problem of the drugs is not a problem that is Colombia specific. It's an issue of the region, and it's of great concern. And, you know, as ambassador many times I thought, I wish I could stand up and just talk about the biodiversity of Colombia, which is so beautiful. Or maybe about Shakira and Juanes, whose music is wonderful. Or maybe about Botero or about García Márquez. But I always felt I needed to talk about the drugs because this is a challenge that for my country has been very difficult. It's basically a challenge to our democracies. So now that we have been able to improve, we are finding that we can go in, and we are working with Mexico right now. We have been helping them with their police. We've been working with Guatemala. We are working with Haiti. We went into Haiti before the earthquake, even more so now, to work with their police, with Trinidad and Tobago, in sharing with them this expertise that unfortunately we had to gain. How do you fight kidnapping? How do you fight anti-narcotics? How do you share information? How do you maintain good intelligence? What do we know about the way the money laundering works? And in the year 2009, we launched two maritime interdiction international courses where we had officers from 12 different Latin American countries coming to Colombia to work with us on how we could improve the interdiction as we worked with you on, with these boats called Midnight Express, And you get on them, and they and this is to go out in the evenings and to be able to capture some of these drug lords. We've written a memorandum of understanding with the Haitian ministry to be able to help them with the police. And we are working then with many of our neighbors on security, but we're also working with them on other issues such as education, with Costa Rica, with El Salvador. We've been sharing our experience in education. We're also working on risk prevention. And these are the kind of programs that we think, and we are starting to see how we can work with the US. Colombia feels that it is now ready to play a much stronger regional role. And you may have seen that with President Santos, he has been working closely with our neighbors. He's been working with UNASUR. He's trying to establish greater relations and working on what President Uribe had done with Central America and the way we're trying to reach out to the Caribbean to become much more regional players. And we're finding that this goes in the same line of thought that President Obama is suggesting, that we work as a region, that we help each other based on our good experiences, and in that way, we work together on a partnership which is not only bilateral, but is a partnership then that allows us to reach out to the region and to address new issues. One of the new issues that has been around, but which for Colombia is fundamental in Panama, is a free trade agreement. Colombia and the US negotiated a free trade agreement 4 years ago, and it is still in Congress, and we saw just recently that President Obama had wanted to pass the Korean trade agreement, and just 2 days ago he found that they hadn't been able to finish the negotiation. Well, Colombia has already finished the negotiation 4 years ago, and why does it make sense to continue to work on trying to pass the trade agreement? Colombia already passed it, and passed it twice, because we passed the original trade agreement that was defined by our two countries. And when the Democrats won the majority in Congress in the year 2008, they suggested that there be incorporated into these trade agreements some additional principles that had to do with labor and that had to do with the environment. And they had to be, and they were to be incorporated in the trade agreement. So we passed those additional requirements once again through our Congress. And this for the US makes a lot of sense. Why? Because the US has allowed us to send in most 98% of our goods come into the US tariff-free already, because this was one of the ways you were helping us to fight drugs, by making it easier for our products to come in here. So all this would do was allow your companies not to pay tariffs. So basically, we're just leveling the playing field, and it's not a new competition for American businesses, because we've already had access to your markets for the last 20 years. So in that, it's not a challenge to new products. It expands the market for the US to 47 million new Colombians. And the US is losing out to other countries. We signed a trade agreement with Canada, and that will be going into force next year. We signed a trade agreement with Europe. And what did the US find, for example, with Chile, where it took a while to get that trade agreement going, and Chile passed it first with Canada and then with the US? US companies lost market share. And 2 years ago, when I was talking to the Chilean ambassador, they still haven't been able to regain it, because buyers get new sellers, and then they're not going to make the change. We are your largest agricultural importer. We buy corn, we buy soy, we buy wheat from you, because we're a tropical country. We're on the equator, so we don't produce these. And what's happening now? Because we have a trade agreement with Argentina and Brazil, with Mercosur, and because we're going to have a trade agreement with Canada, we have already replaced half of our of what we bought from the US, it's now coming from Argentina and Canada, so that you're losing the possibility of selling agricultural goods. And it is, but what we find is most interesting, and what Latin America and the region finds most interesting, it's that it's another way to strengthen our region. We need political ties, we need cooperation ties, but we need trade ties. And we have found that our strongest allies who've been writing letters to the Speaker of the House are those countries in Latin America that already have a free trade agreement, because they see it, if we have a larger zone where we can trade, it's going to be for the benefit of all of us. So President Bachelet, when she was president, and now the new president, the President Alan Garcia, the day he was signing his trade agreement, President Calderon, before President Fox, the Central American presidents, the Canadian, have all written and said, pass a free trade agreement with Colombia and Panama. This will strengthen our region. It's the right signal, and it's good for our trade. So regionally, and this is another aspect that I think we need to keep on working together, moving from the bilateral into the regional is how we strengthen these areas. But I also think that with the new regional approach, there's a possibility of working in new areas. And we have been working with the US government in several initiatives that have started. One is called Pathways to Prosperity. Another one is on energy and climate partnership. And the other one is on social networks. And Deputy Steinberg, the Deputy Secretary of State, went down to Colombia just a month ago. And they set up three high-level tables to talk precisely of renewable energy in one, science and technology in another, and human rights in the third. These are the kind of initiatives that we think we should be working on. Colombia has been working on, especially in biofuels. And we have been helping to set up some small biofuel plants in El Salvador, Guatemala, Panama, and Mexico. We've been involved in educational and vocational training. And I must say that one of the most important accomplishments, and today I was very happy to hear that you have an exchange program with Colombia in the business school, which I hope will be indicative of the other kinds of programs that we're getting going with other universities, is we have the Peace Corps are going back. Colombia was the first country that had Peace Corps. The first group that went out, Peace Corps, went to Colombia. It was a large group of 40. We had a president at that moment who's called Alberto Lleras Camargo, who was a very good friend of Kennedy. So when Kennedy set up the Alliance for Progress and set up the group of Peace Corps, Colombia got a very important group. Unfortunately, as happened to Colombia in 81, the Peace Corps left because of security. And so when I got to Washington 4 years ago, you know, somebody said to me, you really need to get more ambassadors because that's a really difficult job and you only have a very small embassy. I only have 12 diplomats. And so they said, you know, Peace Corps are always wonderful ambassadors because when they go to a country, then they have this wonderful relationship with that country. And it just so happened that they were celebrating 40 years of having been in Colombia. It was a group of Latin Americans. And they came over. Our hymn is more difficult than to sing than the Star Spangled Banner. Did you go up and down, and the words you never see written anywhere else except in our national anthem. And so they still remembered all this and had wonderful memories about Colombia. I said, have you been back? No. Why? Because of security. I said, if I organize a group to go, will you come? Oh, yes. So I started working with them, and 2 years later, 200 Peace Corps went down to Colombia. And President Uribe received them, and we talked about the new Colombia. And then they went back to the little towns where they had been. And they found that that little girl that they taught a nursery rhyme was now a grandmother and still sang the nursery rhyme to them. Or that the room where they had lived was exactly the same. Or that the town decided to have a big ajiaco, a big sort of soup together, because they remembered him so well. And there was another boy who was a judge here in the US who was able to make it through law school here because these gringos who went there as a Peace Corps were very, very generous and helped him to get into school here. So there are these wonderful stories, And I think this is another line that's so important in our relationship and in our regional relationship, is how we strengthen education, how we strengthen our exchange programs. So as I finish, I would just like to say that Colombia and the U.S. have had a very long-standing friendship. We were with you on the Peace Corps. We both went to Korea and fought together. And you were there when we needed you in the year 2000. And I think that this is a relationship that is now ready and mature enough so that we can work with this more regional perspective. We have these new areas to work together. Colombia is ready to do so. I think the U.S. too. And so I would like to say that this is a wonderful partnership that should be moving from a very strong bilateral relationship to a strong regional relationship, and a partnership that was fundamental in helping us address the issues of security. And we're now ready to move on to other issues, but remembering that we have a regional role to play and where we want to play this leadership role, and are delighted and want to do it with the U.S. and take advantage of all those lessons that we learned together and continue to face the challenges together. I think by doing it together, we will be able to address this very, very difficult issue, but also take advantage of all the wonderful opportunities in Latin America. The data that is coming out shows that this is an area that's growing. This is an area that has great potential. It's an area that needs to work on education. And I think that there we have our work cut out. And I think what's important is we all stand up and move forward. So thank you very, very much for this opportunity. And I'm delighted to take any questions that you might have.